Hi. My name's Rebecca, and I'm an addict. Hi. I stand before you tonight just as an addict among addicts, no more, no less. I want to start out by saying that I'm up here, but I have sat down there many, many times, and all I'm here to give you is my journey, my experience, strength, and hope, my path to being the human being that I was born and meant to be. And so I'm so grateful and so humbled and so nervous. And, you know, I just have to remember that my goal in life is to be a worker among workers, a woman among women, an addict among addicts, a human being among human beings. If I do that, I'm enough. I'm enough. And every single person sitting in this room is enough. And if you leave with nothing else tonight, I want you to know that. Because that is what recovery is about. It's not about becoming this or getting to that or making it here. It's about being enough. So thank you. Thank you for letting me share tonight. I want to thank the committee. God, you guys are the nicest people. I swear to God. They picked us up at the airport. They took us to dinner. I mean, really, it's one could get used to this. It's really, it's really a blast. So thank you to the committee for the honor of asking. I just want to also just shout out once to my husband who came with me to this. You know, we've been on this recovery road together for 17 years, and we've had our rough patches, but the one thing I know, and I know he knows, that what we care most about for each other is that we continue on this path and we live the life we were meant to live. So I just want to acknowledge him. I'm going to work against my vain better instincts and put my glasses on so I can read a couple notes. I've been to a couple meetings so far. I heard Ebony last night. God, what you were so great. And went to the women's meeting this afternoon. And I'm struck every time I come to a convention by how different and yet the same our stories are. So the only story I have to tell is my story. And it may ring, you know, it may resonate for some of you. It may not be the experience you have, but the great thing about staying in this room is if you stay here long enough, you will hear what you need to hear. You will hear your story and you will find your way. So I'm just gonna tell you mine and we'll take it from there. What recovery has been about for me is redemption and freedom. And I don't mean redemption in the religious sense. I mean redemption in the how bad can it get, and then how much better can it be? I mean being able to look in the mirror and not cringe. And I mean being able to wake up in the morning and not be filled with such a deep dread and depression and sadness and grief and pain and sorrow and wishing that I didn't have to wake up. And I'm telling you, every morning that you wake up and you don't have to feel like that, that's a gift. That's a gift. So I want to start out by saying that I was born and raised in San Francisco. I'm like most addicts, you know, I don't get too far from what I know. So I still live there. And but I, you know, I spent a lot of time in early recovery thinking about how I became an addict, why I became an addict, whose fault it was that I was an addict, which parent could I blame for the fact that I was an addict? Which side of my family had addicts in it that had passed it down from generation to generation? And you know what? I don't even bother anymore because it doesn't matter. I am what I am. And there's no one to blame. I am what I am, and now it's my responsibility to be what I can be. So I'm over it. My parents loved me the way they knew how to love their child. And I know now that I have my own child, that's all you can do. You do the best with your children, and they're on their own path. And I know too many people in recovery who've raised too many children that had to fight their own fights to think that it's something about what we do to other people. And I'm not talking about horrible childhoods, but my childhood was not a horrible childhood. It was a childhood where from a very early age I felt like I wanted something more. I always felt like there was never enough. You know those never enough childhoods, like my mom would put this much food on the plate and before I ate one bite, I was sure it wasn't enough. And then I was worried about how big the other servings people were getting were, because would there be enough extra? And that sort of started my whole hoarding habit in life. You know, even now, I buy the half-pound bag of M&Ms because I'm worried that if I buy the little bag of M&Ms, you see, just that I characterize it as little tells you everything you need to know about me. The single-serving bag of M&Ms, that it will not be enough. And that's what I remember feeling in my childhood. There's not going to be enough for me. It started with food. I'm not going to get enough food. I'm not going to get enough attention. I'm not going to get enough love. I'm not going to get enough positive reinforcement. I'm not going to be taken care of in the world. I don't have anything underneath me. That's what I remember feeling my whole life. There's nothing underneath me to catch me. There's not enough. And so I spent a lot of years trying to find it. What was going to make me enough? And, you know, all I can tell you is that until I walked into these rooms, I never found an answer. I never found an answer. And I want to say that although I have a lot of stories I could tell about who I was before I got clean, I never got anywhere close to being who I wanted to be till I walked into this room, you know. And it's a funny thing. We're all children at one point, and we have these dreams for ourselves, and we believe that we can accomplish anything. And then time passes, and it slips away. And then if you're an addict, you turn into a person you couldn't even imagine being, a person you never would want to be. And there you are, and you wake up and you wonder how I got so far from who I thought I was to who I am. Because see, we tell ourselves, we create belief systems, we create stories to make it okay, right? So every time we do the next thing that we never were going to do, we've already told ourselves a story. So it started for me very young. I lied. I lied from a very early age. I lied to make myself more important. I lied to make myself more interesting. I lied to make you like me more. I lied because it was easier than telling you the truth. And that's how I started to create this story about who I was and this belief system about how I would get my needs met, right? And then, and the problem is you can't, those things don't stop themselves. So I was a child, I lied a lot. I lived in a fantasy world. I wanted to be a different person than I was. And I'm just gonna tell one story about that because it will really illustrate. You know, I had a boyfriend when I was a teenager, and he was my first boyfriend, and he really loved me. And I really loved him to the best of my ability. And I, of course, had never had sex before. But But the idea of being that vulnerable with another human being was so incomprehensible to me that I told this person before we had sex, oh no, you're not the first person I've ever had sex with. And then I made up this person that I had had sex with to make him feel less than. I said, oh no, he was 22, he rode a motorcycle, he was, you know, I didn't even know anyone who was 22 and rode a motorcycle. But the point is that at that early an age, it was all about protecting me. I had no regard for the other human being involved. And that is a theme that continued throughout my entire using history. No regard for any other human being involved. Manipulative, dishonest. I don't know, there must be more words to describe that kind of person, but I think you get my point. And but of course, the other thing I did was I deprived myself of any real intimacy or joy or closeness or creating a memory with someone because I just couldn't be that vulnerable. So if by 15 I was already there, you can only imagine how it got as the years went on. And you know what happened for me is that I had parents who were both damaged by their own childhoods, and they just couldn't find a way to live with each other that worked. And so my father had serial affairs, and my mother sort of hung on, and I got these messages very early on about relationships and the tenuous, dangerous, painful nature of relationships. And my father, when I was about 14 years old, my mother, when I was about 14 years old, discovered she had breast cancer, and my father left. And, you know, I want to say that I'm 47 years old now, and I have now I've lost people in my life. And what had happened is my father had just lost his mother, and he couldn't face the thought of another long illness and loss. But I didn't understand any of that then. What I understood is that my mother got sick, my father left, nothing was safe in the world, no one's gonna take care of you if you don't take care of yourself. So just put one foot in front of the other and walk right over whoever you have to get where you need to get what you need to be okay. And, you know, that began the process for me of shutting down, shutting down, shutting down, shutting down. I always did well in school, so that was one place where I was able to succeed. And, you know, but I had a very deep need to be loved in an unconditional way. I didn't know what it was then. You know, I wanted to be beautiful because I thought beautiful people are loved unconditionally. But really, it's just that I wanted to be loved unconditionally. And what happened is I was away at college, and I came home for summer break. My mother was in the hospital, which she was a lot, and I wasn't able really to be there for her. I just didn't have the capacity. And one day they said she was coming home the next day, and then that night she died. And all I can say is that the next morning I was rummaging through her medicine chest and taking as many of the pain medication pills as she had that I could put my hands on. And that's what I did for the next however many years, because I could not even comprehend how alone I felt in the world. And, you know, I'll just say that I got clean about 10 years after that, and what I came to understand through that was that you don't avoid grief. You cannot avoid grief. You can run from it. You can spend years taking things to keep it at bay, and when they go away, it'll be there as if it was yesterday. So what does that say to me? Why bother? Right? Why bother? Let me just walk right into it, because you don't have any choice. So my experience is that I didn't avoid anything. I just delayed for 10 years and destroyed my life and, you know, et cetera, the inevitable. So anyway, I go along. My father's gone. My mother is gone. And I have nobody who really cares what I do. And so I start my descent into addiction. And it's a long time ago now, so I don't talk too much about it. I used to tell a lot of funny stories. They seemed funny to me. And I always say a few things because I know when I was new, you know, I just needed to know that the person up here was the kind of addict I was. So, I was the kind of addict that, went to work in a doctor's office and then stole and forged prescriptions. I was the kind of addict that went to work at a university and embezzled money. I was the kind of addict who went to work as a topless change girl and found out you could make more money turning tricks. I was the kind of addict who would steal drugs from my best friend if she left them in the house that we shared. I was the kind of addict who would do anything with anyone, anywhere, to get loaded. And that's what I did. And when I talk about the lies we tell ourselves, you know, I used to describe my years as a stripper as a feminist statement. I swear to God, I had some idea that I was making a stand for women's independence. We're delusional. That's what we are. We tell ourselves whatever we need to tell ourselves to be able to get up and do it again, right? I had this whole theory about, you know, drugs and the system oppressing people, and the way you fight back against oppression is you kill yourself. I mean, fuck the man, you know. Now, of course, like that commercial, I am the man. But, I just built this whole fiction about who I was. Rebecca, feminist, anarchist, unemployed, novelist, bullshit. But it made it possible for me to go on for a long time, because of course what I started out saying is the truest thing, which is I had dreams about who I wanted to be. You know, I wanted to be a nice human being that other people cared about. I wanted to be a person who produced something of value in society. I told my daughter, asked me the other day if I'd ever been arrested. And, you know, here's another one of those examples. I was loaded one night with a friend of mine, and we were lurching around this college town, and I saw a policeman arresting somebody. So I decided he was using excessive force, and I needed to intervene. And I did. And of course I was arrested, and of course the story I told myself and others for many years, into recovery years, was that I was coming to the aid of somebody who was the victim of police brutality. Okay, I was an obnoxious, slobbering, bitchy drunk that got in the middle of something that was none of my business. And then When the officer tried nicely to ask me to go away, I started to hit him. So the other day my daughter said, "Have you ever been arrested?" And I said, "Yes, I'll tell you about that another time." So in this life, and you know, I think you could tell from listening to me, I'm a middle class addict, right? I broke a bottle over someone's head once. That was exciting. But I'm an embezzler. I'm a very bad prescription forger. I'm a borrow money from your relatives until you can't borrow anymore. I'm a student loan even though you're not in school kind of an addict, you know. That's just the kind of addict I am. And I hung around with a lot of people who were much, more in that world than I was, but I'm a chicken shit. And I wanted other people to go cop for me. I wanted to, because I had illusions about who I was. And so what happened is, you know how we all have that moment of truth in our addiction, right? And so I'm working in an office in downtown San Francisco. You know, that people hired me, really. I went to this job interview with hoop earrings this big and a skirt this short. And they hired me for this receptionist job in a law school. And I'm at work one day and I take off from my usual 3-hour lunch and I get on the BART train in San Francisco and I go cop and I go into the BART bathroom. They used to open, you can't even use them anymore, I'm plunging around for a vein. And I look up and I see myself in the mirror in my little Dianne Feinstein blouse. And, you know, there's blood and I can't find a vein and I'm desperate and I'm sick. And I see the look in my eyes and I'm an animal. And you can't lie to yourself when you see that. There's no more illusion when you're face to face with what you really are. And in that moment, I was face to face with who and what I really was. And it was devastating because all the lies I told myself, all the building up of this fragile sense of who I was were gone in that moment. And there I was, and there just was no sugarcoating it. But did I stop, you ask? Not yet, because I found a vein and moved on. Welcome to the disease of addiction. Same thing over and over, expecting different results. No, when I stopped was, when my mother died, I inherited a bunch of money, which I spent. And then I had my best friend, my only friend, really, by the end. Her grandmother died, and she inherited a bunch of money. And I never forget, she's still clean, and we're still friends today. And she said to me, and we had spent all my money getting high, of course, and she said to me, "I think we should get clean." And I'm like, "Excuse me?" She had a better self-preservation button working than I did, let me just say. So anyway, true to her word, we started going to meetings. And, you know, me, I was just going to stick with her for a while because I'm sure it wasn't going to last, and then we were going to get to the money. But we started going to meetings, and sometimes we went high, and sometimes we didn't. And what I want to say is that... I'm sure there are people that disagree with me, but this is just my opinion, which is I don't care what condition you're in when you come to a meeting. I don't care. I'd rather have you in the room than in the street. Doesn't mean I want you talking. But I want you there. All right, moving on. So here I am. I'm in meetings now. That is the right place for me to be. I know right away. And you know why? Not because of the recovery part, because of the unconditional love part. You're talking to a woman who's like starving for some unconditional love from strangers. So I'm in the program and I love it. I get into it. I'm secretarying meetings. I'm coffee maker. I remember the first meeting I ever spoke at, I took 2 hours to decide what earrings to wear. That is how superficial my approach to the world was. But it's true. You know, and we used to have these CHIP meetings in San Francisco. I say to people, I would stand all the way in the back when it was my day to get a CHIP, wearing something really short. And then, thank you, back in the day. And then they'd announce 60 days, and I would start the walk. High point of early recovery for me. Okay, so now you're getting a fuller picture of who I am. So anyway, but the point is, who cares? Who cares? I was where I needed to be, and until I figured out what I really needed to get, I was getting stuff that was keeping me there. Who cares why we're here? Bring a paper, bring a friend, come because the jail sends you. Who cares? You're an addict, you're in the right place. So for a while, that worked. And then that stopped working, and I didn't know what you did next. That's a problem. So I started drinking beer. And you know, I don't know why. I never liked beer that much, but I started to get really uncomfortable in social situations, and some of the social situations were in non-NA situations. And so just I drank a little beer. And you know, all I can say is that I just didn't hear the alcohol part. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I thought, God, if I'm not sticking a needle in my arm, it can't get any better than that. And so a few beers are okay. And what happened is that I was somewhere where I was drinking and I wasn't where my support system was, and somebody had some drugs. And of course, that was it. So this is, I'm about 13 months in NA at this point. And you know, I think I'm hot shit. I'm sponsoring people, I'm a secretary, I have service commitments. God help those people. You know, and so I have this episode where I'm out of town and I do some drugs, and I know that I can't lie. And two things occurred to me immediately. One is relief that I have to tell the truth. And the second is I will never admit that I was using during that first 13 weeks. And what happens in these rooms is you are incapable of living that kind of lie if you want to stay clean. Incapable. So all I'm saying is, whatever you think, you never have to tell anyone, because it doesn't matter. I'm here to tell you, if you want to stay clean, find someone and tell them. So finally, I got up the courage. I think it was another year or so. I'm brave. And you know, it was this big meeting, and really, I thought I was going to rock the foundations of NA in San Francisco with the news of my dishonesty. And you know what? Raised my hand, said, you know, I need to say that during my first 13 months, I drank some beer, and I just need to own that. And then secretary called on the next person. And that was it. That was it for you guys. But you know what? For me, it was the beginning. Because I told the truth on myself, which is something I never did in my life. My theory was, if you didn't know, it wasn't true. Right? I'm not responsible for anything. You know, it's sort of like if a tree falls in the forest and you hear it, did it really fall or something like that. There's some saying like that, but it's sort of like, you know, if I don't tell anyone I did that really horrible thing, did I really do it? So when I figured out that part of the road to me, for me was to be able to tell the truth about who I was, it was such a moment of freedom. I can't tell you how great I felt after that meeting. I can't even tell you. And that for me was really the beginning of my recovery. And you know, I want to talk a lot about, not a lot, don't panic. I want to talk about sort of early recovery and just what that feels like, because I was watching those people come up and get their books. And for me, it was such a weird mixture of wanting attention and not wanting attention, and, you know, wanting to be part of and not wanting to be part of. And I had such low self-esteem, and I was so needy at the same time, which is just a terrible combination. And I'm so lucky that the people who I got connected to were such decent, honest people. You know, I just found a group of people, and they were so loving. And many of them aren't with us anymore. And that's the other thing I want to say. One of the speakers at the women's meeting said today, you know, it's like a, I'll get this wrong, but you'll get the general idea. It's like a river, you know, we flow with each other for a while and then we flow apart. I thought that was such a beautiful way to put what happens in these rooms. Because if you said to me in your first year clean, who were the five people you spent the most time with, I would tell you, I would give you five people who aren't here anymore. They're dead from all spectrum of diseases that happen in life, or they went out and they got loaded, or they moved. But the point is that the only thing constant in your recovery is your recovery. All the rest is the gifts that come along the way to help you walk the next quarter mile, half mile, 5 miles, 20 miles. And so, you know, it's not about hanging on, and it's not about my best friend today is going to be my best friend in 10 years. It's that we carry each other. That's how it works here. We each carry each other for a few miles, and it might be that you carry me 1 year, and then 2 years later, I carry you. And it might be that the person with 10 days carries the person with 20 years on the night that that person is in pain. But it's not about mapping out a life for ourselves that's always going to be the same people, because the nature of this disease will not allow that. You know? I mean, a lot of us did a lot of damage to our bodies over the years. And, you know, I know I'm not alone when I say that there are things I have as a result of my disease that could kill me. But while I'm here, I get to walk with whoever else is here with me, and it matters. The most important person in my first year in recovery was a guy named Bruce, who called me every Sunday morning and said, I just wanted to wake you up and tell you that I love you today, and I'm so glad we're in recovery together. You know, and 3 years, and we weren't sleeping together. He wasn't trying to, you know, it was just about the human connection. And you know, he OD'd and died. But that doesn't change what he did for me that first year. I refuse. I refuse to take away from people just because they don't make it as long as I want them to make it. When you're here, right? The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop using. Getting to the end of my list. Oh, humility. I love that subject. So here I am. I'm a few years clean, and I meet a guy. You know, I'd met a few guys along the way, but the way it worked for me is I sort of would scope out the room, and then the guy who seemed the least interested, I would say, that's the one for me. And then I would go see if I could win that guy. Okay, just a hint. Winning and relationships, it's not the same thing. Right? It's actually about connecting. But I won't go into it. It had to do with my father and getting, you know, what I needed. Who cares? The point is, you got to find someone who wants to have a relationship back. Okay? That took me a few years. And you know when I learned it? When a guy I was dating said to someone else, oh no, we're not in a relationship. And I thought to myself, well, I was in one. And then I realized, of course, I was in one by myself. So a guy came along who wanted to actually be in a relationship too, and happened to want to be in it with me too. And so those are the two keys for anyone who's not clear. They got to want to be in a relationship, and it's got to be with you. Some things take a while to figure out, but we get there. Anyway, so, you know, he and I hung out together, and we had a great time. And then, you know, at some point, we've been going out for a while, and you know, he said to me, you know, this is what I'm looking for. Are you down for that? And I, you know, and it was commitment, it was monogamy, it was honesty. And I'm like, oh, God. You know, I hadn't had any expectations on me since my mom got sick, and I'm 14 years old. Right after that, wasn't that my mom didn't love me and care. She had no strength to raise a child. She was dying. Nobody cared what I did. And all of a sudden, I had some guy saying to me, I want you to, I want you to be in this. I want you to give it your all. I want it to be real. And it scared the piss out of me. Because, you know, when you're a liar and a cheat and you don't really know how to talk to another human being, honestly, that's a pretty daunting task. But what I learned is that I love to actually live up to people's expectations. And so I tried, and you know what? I could do it. And that's what I've learned here, is that there's nothing I can't do. There's nothing we can't do. We could choose not to do things. But really, there's a lot of free choice involved. So anyway, we got married. We got married, okay? My parents are divorced, his parents are divorced. We don't know anyone who's married. We don't know anyone who's had a successful marriage ever. So we get married, we don't know what we're doing. We're just trying to put one foot in front of the other. We're trying to live in recovery. We're trying to do the next right thing. We're trying to create a life for each other and for ourselves. And that's what happens here, is it's like a snowball going down a mountain. You know, one minute you're in your third meeting and you're thinking, oh, I'm going to vomit. And the next thing you know, you got kids, you got, you're married, you got a job. You're like, holy shit, when did this happen? And you know, you did it all one day at a time. That's how we do everything. And then you get older, and then you get younger again. Anyway, and then we decided we'd have a baby. Another thing, we had no clue. No clue. I'm telling you, we brought that kid home from the hospital. We were like, you know, deers in the headlight. But, of course, our higher powers give us what we can handle in life. So we got this mellow baby who was just a joy. And I want to say one more thing about my daughter, who's, you know, who I just adore. But this is really important. I want to say that one of the deepest beliefs I had about myself that I never would say out loud, not to my sponsor, not in a meeting, was that I was incapable of unconditional love. That I was incapable of it because I had never actually experienced it. Because, or maybe I did when I was a child, but I was so shut down that so everything was conditional. Even my, you know, I loved my husband, but not unconditionally. You know, it's just the truth. That would have taken too much vulnerability and trust. So what I learned when I had my child was that I was capable of unconditional love, and it was such a relief for me because I knew that was the first time I knew that there wasn't something irretrievably broken in me. You know, I sort of believed before that no matter what, there was something really bad inside of me because really through it all, I'm still, you know, I was still selfish and narcissistic and all the things that we are, all the things that addiction is a disease of self-obsession. And so I really believed deep down that I was incapable of putting another human being before me. And what I learned with my child was that I wasn't. And then I started to finally be able to practice that with other people. And I think the thing about unconditional love is that unless you love yourself unconditionally, you can't love anyone else unconditionally. So the starting point is total acceptance of who we are. You know, not just only accepting the things we like about ourselves, but accepting everything. You know, I am compassionate and vain. You know, I am committed and lazy. Human beings are complicated. There's nothing simple about us. We live in a world that is so conflicted between our heads and our hearts and our genitals and our, I mean, we're just, it's a tough road, right? So we're flawed. We're gloriously, beautifully, spectacularly flawed. I love that about us. You know, I love that about the human condition. And by the way, there's a lot of people who don't have these rooms to come to who live in a lot more pain than we do because they don't have anywhere to come say, this is who I am and I love myself anyway. So I'm so grateful to be here. And I just, you know, you get a life, right? You get a life. And so I got my kid, got my husband, got my career. I had a career. I was into my career. Oh, my God, I love to work. Really, I love to feel smart and engaged and work and be paid well. And, you know, I really got into it. And I'll just tell you a little story about humility. I was at the top of my game. I traveled a lot. My kid was in good shape. My marriage was in good shape. I was in the middle of this great, exciting career moment. And two things happened right one after another, and I, you know, I have some time to reflect, but the first one was that my father, who I had a very distant relationship with, but who was the love of my life when I was a girl, I loved him, I loved him. You know, he dropped dead. And I hadn't really made it right. And you know what? I never will. And that's just true. And that's just true. So, and we live with that. That's what we have to live with. It doesn't mean I can't get right with it. I am right with it. You know, God and I and my dad, we're right. But what I can never do is say to him what I should have said to him when he was alive, and I wish I had. And right after that, I got this high-powered new promotion job, and then there was a giant political fight in the arena I work in, and then I was fired. And you know what? I never been fired in my life. And I was fired before I even started a day of work. I was fired because they fired the guy that brought me in, and they fired everyone he brought in. And I'm telling you, those two things, I went spinning. And I had a lot of years in recovery that were easy. They were easy. I did the work, but not that much. Right? Not that much. And, you know, I stayed in touch, but not close enough. And when that happened to me, I lost sight of who I was. And I'll tell on myself, which is that this job I had, you know, had events that you got to wear gowns to. And, you know, you have never met a woman who loves a gown more than me. And so I had collected 3 or 4 or 5 gowns over the period of time. And one day after my father died and after I lost this job and had to take another job, which, let me tell you, did not require gowns, I was down in my closet looking through my gowns and crying. And I thought to myself, that is pathetic. That is like spending 2 hours on what earrings you're going to wear. You are mourning all the wrong things here, and you have lost track of what it is that matters to you. And you know, what I realized is I got so in to the gowns and the title and the money and the hot shit flying around the country to go to important meetings. I was so into it that it had become who I thought I was. And when they took that away without even knowing me, I was so blown away that I was just dropped to my knees. And I freaked out. I freaked out. I moved out. Gotta go, honey. I moved out. I moved out actually during the hot shit period. That's when I said, gotta go, right? I have to find myself. Oh, God. You know, what I wanted, I had a moment. Let me put it this way. This is what I know about myself. I had a moment where I forgot that the only fucking reason that I had ever got within 50 feet of a gown was Narcotics Anonymous. And I started to think I was something special, that I had some special place in the world, and that I didn't need the people in Narcotics Anonymous, because, you know, I had the people in Hollywood. I had the people in New York. And my head was so far up my ass at 15 years clean, 15, 16, 17 years clean, that really, you know what God said? A little clue is not going to do it here. You know? A tap on the shoulder isn't working with her. Okay? So I'm going to take her ass out. And that's what happened. And from this vantage point, thank God he did. Thank God he did. Because you want to see someone go back to meetings in a hurry. You want to see someone cry at meetings, sob at meetings, break down at meetings. You just take away everything they think makes them who they are. And that's what happened. And it was so great. Because you know what? When the dust settled, I was fine. I got another job. I gave all, well, I gave a couple of the gowns to Goodwill. I'm waiting. I'm hopeful. You know, and I moved on. Kevin and I came back together. It's not, has, you know, it's a rough road, right? It was a hard time. My father died. I shut down. I left. He shut down. We had two shut down people trying to find their way back to each other. It wasn't easy. And you know, what did it for us was our daughter. Because one thing we promised each other, no matter what our own petty, selfish needs are, we brought another human being into the world, and she gets to feel safe all the time. All the time. So, you know, we made up our mind, and we're working through it. And I just, you know, I feel like all this is a way of saying that you come here, and it's just a search for who you are. It's just a path. I want to talk, I haven't said anything about the steps, and you know, there are people who are better at talking about the steps than I am. I just think that we're people that need to use every tool available to us, and I believe in that, and I've used every tool available to me. I want to talk about sponsorship and service. They're what keep you connected to other people. We will all have periods. Anyone who's clean will have periods of time where you don't go to as many meetings, where you say, these aren't my people, where you say, why am I still hanging around here? You know, when you're clean for decades, like people are, it's human nature to question whether you need. I'm not afraid. One of the things I love about how big and brave recovery's gotten is, you know, I'm not afraid anymore of all the different ways people do it. You don't have to do it my way. You just have to do it. And so, you know, people just struggle with what their place is and where, how much of it is here and how much of it is there and how much of it is in a relationship and what do we give to our kids and what do we give to our careers. And, you know, I wanted to be president of the United States when I was 10 years old. So, you know, I feel like there's shit in the world I should be paying attention to besides what happens, not because I'm going to be president, but because, you know, there's stuff that happens in the real world that matters to me. So we all have to find the balance. But I know for me, sponsorship and service are what keep me connected. And I want to say, you know, I have a group of women. We've been meeting together for years and years, over 5 years now. We have dinner every month, and we tell each other everything. And, you know, those women are the best touchstone I have. And when I first got here, I whined a lot. I was a big whiner. You know, oh, why aren't there more women with time? Oh, how come all the women go to that other program? Oh, what am I going to do? Nobody. You know, whine, whine, whine. And, you know, my sponsor said to me, you know what you can do to make sure there are women with time? And I said, what? And she said, stay. Stay. And I did. So one more story, and then I'm going to close. I want to tell you just a spiritual awakening story. I probably said one more story last time, so forgive me. But, you know, I came from a family where religion was the sop of the week. You know, that was our theory about religion, right? Only weak, pathetic people needed to lean on God. Real people leaned on themselves. And so when I got here, I had a hard time finding my way. And what I did for myself is I made my my God, my higher power was the human spirit, which I really love. And I see it in these rooms. You see people crawl into this room and you watch them open like flowers. I mean, oh my God, what could create that but something bigger than me? I watched my mother, who was sick as a dog, wake up every morning with a fierce will to live and to be loved and to love other people. So, you know, I just get that there's something bigger than me, but I don't have a lot of moments where I really feel it. So I was in Mexico a few years ago, and both my mother and father were dead at this point, and I walked a labyrinth. And, you know, I'm not a quiet person. Really hard for me to be quiet. Really hard for me to meditate. You know, I'm like, oh God, what am I gonna have for lunch? Did I put the laundry in the dryer this morning? I think I didn't close the garage door, shit. You know, just a lot of noise going on up there. So anyway, I'm a big iPod meditator, for what it's worth. But I walked this labyrinth in this beautiful place in Mexico, and I got into it, and I got to the middle, and I was standing in this shaft of sunlight in the middle of this labyrinth, and I swear to God, I was standing there looking up at the sun, and I felt the spirits of my mother and my father come down in that shaft of light and not only put their arms around me, but put their arms around each other. It was such a moment of healing for my family of origin. And all I can tell you is, you know, in my 19 years clean, that was the moment, the most pure moment of knowing that I live in grace that I have ever experienced. But you know what? It'll last me another 20 years. I don't need another one, because it was real, and it happened to me, and it's not someone else's story. And if I want to feel that warmth, all I have to do is close my eyes, and I know it's there. And that's what I want to say about this program. You know, it's a journey towards grace. We're on a journey towards grace, and we're all on it together. And, you know, one step at a time, the next right thing, holding each other's hands, carrying those of us who can't walk ourselves, taking turns, grabbing the people that are falling behind, running to catch up with the people a little bit ahead of us. That's what we're marching for. That's what we're here for. And I'm so honored to be part of this movement, because that's what it is. It's a movement towards grace. So thank you guys so much for letting me share.